Good morning. I want to try again. Good morning. All right. I'm excited to be here. This is a great conference. And obviously, storage and retrieval technologies are pretty darn interesting and very relevant to what we do. You know, as Margo said, I spent a lot of time both at Microsoft and then at Amazon working on storage-related stuff. It's amazing, particularly in the ordering space, there's all sorts of things that happen, but the most interesting problems actually always turn out to be storage related, right? That's where all the scaling bottlenecks are and things like that. Currently, I'm the general manager for S3, which is Amazon's simple storage service. So this is our utility computing storage as a service offering. I'm out of curiosity, how many of you are familiar with, at least generally, Amazon Web Services? A few, so okay, not too bad. How many of you have used one of our web services or used S3 before? Okay, a few. All right. So I'm going to talk. I'll do a little bit of an introduction. I'll try to keep the marketing speak low about what Amazon S3 is by way of background. And then we'll talk a little bit about the design goals we had when we set out to build this. We started about 4 years ago, actually, on the service. And had a set of pretty lofty design goals that we were going after. And then I'll talk a little bit about the role of both failure and uncertainty, and then how those related to how we were going to go about achieving our design goals, and then some of the techniques that we've used to deal with both of those issues as we've built and grown and operated the service. So Amazon S3 is, we call it storage for the internet, nice, broad, and vague, and it's actually kind of purposely that way. We set out to build a storage service that was internet accessible and internet scalable. We wanted a storage service that could be used by any application, anywhere, very broad, and have it scale and support an unlimited number of web scale applications. Like I said, we started on S3 about 4 years ago. About 3 years ago, actually next month, is when it came out of beta and became generally available. So it's actually been around for quite a while. 3 years in this space is actually quite a while. It's a fairly simple service. It's basically an object store. You have objects that you stick in buckets, and that's about it in terms of concepts. So it's not really a file system. The only structure you get is the bucket, and then people use the object naming conventions with WAX and things like this to kind of create directory structures. But it's pretty simple. An object is really anything. It can be, a JPEG. It can be, a database backup. It can be an email message, anything. So we've got lots of different things in there. Since launching the service 3 years ago, we've seen really just tremendous growth in the number of objects stored. So you can see, the first little bar there at the end of our first year, so the end of 2006, we had a couple billion objects stored. By the end of 2007, we were up to about 14 billion. And then by the end of 2008, we were at 40 billion, and we've been continuing to grow from there. So it's really pretty dramatic growth. It is greatly exceeded all of our expectations. In fact, we now have more objects in the system than we thought we ever would, which is sort of interesting. So it's growing fast. It's about 10x growth in 2 years. So definitely some scaling fun there. In terms of how customers are using it, we designed it for any application anywhere, and we're really seeing a broad range of uses with it, some of which we expected and, frankly, some of which we didn't. So we've got customers using it for things you would expect, like backup and archive. Lots from individuals. We've got tools like Jungle Disk, which makes it easy for actually consumers who want to back up their home PCs to S3. Doing that, we've got a bunch of customers that way. We have large enterprises that are using it for backup. In fact, we've got a partnership now with Oracle, so they've built into their product the ability to use RMAN to back up and send your database backups to S3. We have customers using it for sort of, we'll call it application storage or original storage. So we've got a bunch of photo sharing sites. SmugMug is one of our kind of poster children for that. So all of the objects, all of the photos that people store on their site, they don't store them anywhere on their service. They just stick them. They stick them in S3 and then store them and serve them out of there. We have other companies building various applications on it. NASDAQ actually recently stuck all of the historical trade information or quote information for the stock exchange in S3 and built a pretty interesting app. They've one of the things that traders have is they'll have their customers call them and ask them, have questions about the trade that they executed and did they get the best price or was there something funky going on? And the traders can actually use this application that NASDAQ built on top of S3 to go pull up all of the sort of minute-by-minute trade data and go rebuild the historical picture of what the market looked like at the time the trade was made. So, a wide range of stuff. We have people using it as an FTP service, if you will. So, again, it's kind of it demonstrates a lack of other good offerings in the space. But it's simple and easy to use. So, business to businesses that need to move files around and want to do it in a secure way, they'll stick it in S3 and then give permissions to the other party to pull it out of S3, and so they'll use it to transfer. Which is really not a storage thing at all, but they're using it for that. We also had customers that decided that. The CDN offerings out there for content distribution were, there was too much friction involved, it was too expensive, it was too hard for the little guys, whatever. So we have tons of customers that are using us as a CDN, so they will stick all their website images in S3 and then serve their website images out of there. There's a bit of a meme going around in the internet marketing community. I guess Google changed how they rank and search and take performance into the rank in the results. And so all these internet marketers are discovering that their pages load faster if they offload the serving of the content to someplace else so that their little GoDaddy hosting server doesn't, kind of fall over as they get page hits. And so we've got all these little tiny internet marketers storing and serving all their content out of S3. So the broader range of stuff, it's sort of interesting because of the range of uses. Oh, and last but not least is the amount of high-performance computing. With EC2 and with EC2 really opening up, we see a ton of that. And of course, we've got a lot of people that are writing, Hadoop-based processing and then using S3 as basically the file store underneath it. And so that's yet another very different use case that people are doing. So all of these objects that are stored are sort of conglomeration of all these different use cases together. So, like I said, we set out to design S3, and we kind of sat down and said, okay, well, what do we want to build here? We've got a general idea, but we want to write down our goals so that we know that we know what we're shooting for, so that we know when we've succeeded. We knew that we wanted to take all of the experience that we had building Amazon.com and the retail site and all of the lessons that we learned there and apply them to the space. And we wanted to do so in a way that would basically solve the storage problem, if you will, for developers both inside and outside the company. We found that developers within the company were spending a lot of time sort of reinventing the wheel trying to solve these storage issues and not spending time figuring out how they could innovate and build interesting features for their customers and move the website forward. Likewise, external developers we talked to, they were spending a lot of time doing the same thing. We said, well, gosh, if we could solve these problems and do so in a way that was really simple and easy to use, we could solve this problem and drive a lot of innovation above us. So I want to talk a little bit about the goals that we set out for ourselves with the service. So the first one was be durable. There's not too much to say about that other than it's kind of a basic for a storage system. And we defined it kind of two ways. The first is we didn't want to lose data, right? So if you put an object in the store, when you come and ask for it, it better be there. The second was, and it's a little more subtle, is we want to return the right object. So when we store it, what you get back actually should be what you put in, not something different. So the next goal we had was we want to be available, highly available. So this has a bunch of things that fall out of it. So the first one is we want to be always on, no planned downtime. For a while early in its history, Amazon had a page that was called the Gone Fishing page. So if there were a couple of databases that the company had that basically we had to take planned downtime in order to do maintenance on them. That didn't last very long. Obviously, you're losing money every time the site's not up. So one of the things that we wanted to do with this service was to make sure that no matter what, we didn't have to ever take planned downtime. We also didn't want to take unplanned downtime. So it also meant that there was, you know, we wanted to engineer so that we didn't have single points of failure. We wanted to make sure that when or if failure happened, you know, the system could handle it, we could deal with it, and customers wouldn't notice, and the business wouldn't notice that something somewhere inside the service had failed. And then finally, in terms of a numerical goal, we set the goal that we should be meet or exceed 4 nines of availability. So we also want to be scalable. And you know, working with Amazon and having the company have gone through its quick ramp up in scale, you know, one of the things that we found with a lot of the systems that had been early on with the company was that, you know, they work great at low scale, and then you hit this wall, and then they just didn't work anymore. And, you know, a lot of, you know, we go and we talk to the vendors, you know, in some cases we're using proprietary hardware, proprietary software from other vendors, and, you know, we go talk to them about our problem and try to get them to solve it for us, and honestly, they weren't too interested. They were interested in us because we were a large account, but they weren't interested because our needs were so different than what so many of their other customer needs were, right? So they wanted to engineer for the 80%, not the 1%, and we were in the 1%. So we figured out quickly that if we wanted to be scalable and scale to the level that our business needed to grow, we had to do it ourselves. And when we started with S3, we said, well, gosh, you know, the internet's growing, there's going to be more and more of these companies. You know, we want to make sure that, you know, both our business and the external developers that we're enabling don't reach these same sort of scaling bottlenecks and these brick walls that we had hit, and that, you know, they can just continue to grow and the infrastructure grows with them. So, you know, we said we want to be able to support on this platform an unlimited number of web scale apps, right? We wanted to use scale as an advantage. We wanted to engineer this such that, you know, adding hardware made things better, right? What we'd seen actually in practice is often that you add more hardware and things get worse, right? So, you know, we wanted to make sure that as you added more nodes into the overall system, you didn't see a degradation of performance, that you actually saw continued sort of linear scalability as you added more hardware. And that scale was an advantage in terms of improving the robustness, the reliability, and the performance of the platform and of the infrastructure versus the other way around. Security was also a big deal for us. And you know, security can mean a bunch of different things. For us, it meant that we wanted to make sure that we could prevent unauthorized access. So clearly there were some use cases like, you know, website content serving, things like this, where, you know, the access, you want everybody, you know, it's anonymous access, and we wanted to support that. But there are other situations where the data is proprietary or it's, you know, like your database backup, you wouldn't want somebody else necessarily going and be able to grab that. So, you know, we made sure that we wanted to have, you know, secure protocols so that people could get data in and out in a secured way. We wanted to build access control mechanisms and authentication mechanisms. And then we wanted to provide ways that customers could then log and then provide, you know, an audit trail, if you will, of who is accessing their data. We also, as a company, we're kind of nuts about physical security and some of these other things. People actually knock us because we're not super transparent about where our data centers are located. But part of that is because we take security very, very seriously, right? On the retail side of the business, we store millions of customers' credit card numbers, right? That's not something we ever, ever want to be breached. So we're a little bit paranoid about that. And we bring that paranoia to our infrastructure business as well, and that, you know, we take the physical security of our data centers very seriously. You know, we do things like, you know, forensic wipes of the drives before, you know, when they're end of life, before something happened, and, you know, a variety of precautions to make sure that data that was intended to be secure remains secure. So fast was also important to us. You know, something that's really slow, no matter how available or reliable it is, isn't so great if it takes you an eon to get the data out. We, you know, we knew that we wanted to support high performance computing types of apps in conjunction with EC2. We also knew that we wanted, you know, to be able to support applications that were you know, website applications where they were serving directly out of us, and you don't want page load times to take forever. So we knew we wanted to be fast. One of the interesting things with being, you know, an internet storage service is that often, you know, the server-side processing and returning of the data actually happens very quickly, but it's often then the internet latency that slows you down. So, you know, we spend a fair bit of time focusing on the server side for solutions like EC2 and whatnot. We get millisecond range response times from when you're at a close location. Response times can vary then further depending on how far away you are. So we have continued to spend time and release put new data centers in new places to try to reduce internet latency. We also wanted to be simple. Again, it shouldn't take very long to figure out how to use the service. It's amazing how complex some software is. Our service is pretty darn simple. There's get, there's put, there's delete, there's list, there's copy. I think that's it, just about. So it's pretty straightforward. It's very easy to learn. Conceptually, it's not difficult. There's a couple of other more subtle things that then play into this as well, one of which is, there's a variety of solutions as you scale. One of the common ones is to start partitioning data, right? Well, partitioning adds some complexity, and one of the things that we actually explicitly wanted to avoid is we wanted to avoid having our customers have to worry about data partitioning. We wanted that to be our problem. So from an S3 perspective, just pile your stuff in. We have customers that have billions of objects, and they'll go, well, can I stick it in a bucket? Don't I need to create much? How do I partition? No, don't worry about it. Stick it in it. We'll go deal with it. That's our problem, not yours. So that was one of our goals. And finally, our last goal was to be cost effective. You often see technology, which is fabulous technology, but is priced so far out of range that doesn't really matter. We wanted it to matter. We also saw that storage in general sort of interesting in a couple of ways. Traditional storage is definitely not pay as you go, right? You sort of do some forecasting on, how much are you going to need, and then you go buy these big things, and day one you use this much of it, maybe day two you use this much of it, and maybe if you're lucky over the course of time you use most of it. But in general, most storage is really underutilized, and you pay up front for all of that underutilization. So with the service, we wanted it to be pay as you go. We wanted you to pay only for what you used. We also wanted to have no contracts or commitments so that, if you were unhappy for any reason, you could go on. We also then wanted to be able to use, in terms of architecting and designing, we knew that if we were going to get to the cost level that we wanted, it all had to be based on commodity hardware, so no proprietary hardware, third-party hardware in here, all just commodity boxes, and that we wanted to use our software engineering, our expertise and experience from running Amazon.com, and then the scale of the combined businesses in order to really drive down costs. So that's great. So we start off with a set of nice and lofty goals, right? So we're going to build this great service that can, is virtually infinite, it's durable, reliable, scalable, fast, cost-effective, all this sort of stuff. It's great. Okay, so now we're going to sit down and start trying to figure out how we built this thing. And then we start to realize, there's a few things that'd be kind of nice to know, because there's a series of tech trade-offs that you can kind of make if you know a few things. So we started thinking about, what's the average object size going to be? We don't know, right? It sort of depends, right? If it's a website thumbnail, it's going to be one size, right? If it's my database backup, it's going to be a different size. So I don't know my object size. How often are objects going to get accessed? I don't know. It depends, right? It depends on the use case. And, as part of our simple API and our no contract, no commit, our customers don't have to tell us any of this, right? So we don't know any of these things. Our customers don't tell us how long they expect their objects to live, right? Is this something that's going to live for 10 minutes? And we actually do have objects that live for 10 minutes. Or is this an object that's going to live for 10 years? We don't know, right? As you start to run, maybe you can start to see some of this, and it's true, you can, as you start to run and operate the thing, you can start to see what's happening and whatnot, but things change. So you're going along and, it's kind of looking like this, and all of a sudden it's looking like this, right? So, for example, we've had customers that use us to host content, and you're kind of going along at this rate, and they got picked up on Slashdot or TechCrunch. Whoop. They didn't know it was coming. We didn't know it was coming. But yet we need a system that's going to continue to achieve our goals even in light of these things. So there's a lot of things that we just don't know. So where we kind of ended up was, I guess we're just not going to know these things. So, you know, over time, maybe we can, you know, get smart and we can build intelligence into the system to respond and deal, but they aren't going to be things that we know a priori, right? And in general, actually, this is true of general purpose systems. In fact, you know, when I worked on SQL Server, you know, this would happen all the time where we'd get these hotfix requests in from customers and we'd look at them and we'd look at what they're doing. We're like, what the heck are they doing? Why are they doing that, right? You know, well, because they could. You know, and the thing with general purpose systems is, you know, if you can, you can, right? And there's nothing that says, well, we never intended it to do that. Well, but you built it and it worked and it was working up until a point. So this is just one of the things that kind of comes with the territory. And so it's something that you have to embrace as you start to design one of these systems. So you have to understand that things are going to change, that what things look like today are not going to be what they look like tomorrow. But you also kind of have to just make some assumptions, right? And then you try to validate those assumptions as you go on. And on, you know, the prior page, there are a whole bunch of things, and we in the initial design, we made assumptions about basically all of them. Now, luckily, most of those assumptions actually didn't get baked into the actual design. And I say luckily because we were wrong about just about every single one of those up front. It's been sort of interesting. Now, the place where it's come into play is, you know, things like capacity planning and, you know, trying to figure out what your cost structure is going to be like and things like this. But luckily, we sort of, from a design perspective, said, you know, we don't know a lot of these things, and so we're going to try to design not assuming them. So the other thing, as we sat down, we said, well, okay, you know, from our experience, you're running Amazon.com, we know that stuff fails too. You know, like it or not, stuff's going to fail. And, you know, we, very early on in the history of the company, right, we went through some of this iteration, and I think it's, it happens, you see it with all large sort of web scale infrastructure, that there's a period of sort of iteration and refinement that goes on. And we certainly did a lot of trying, a lot of failing, and then a lot of failing better. Yeah, this stuff isn't easy, but there are some things that you can learn, and over time you can fail better, and you can fail in such a way that doesn't impact customers and doesn't impact your business. So it's basically, you know, if a tree falls in the forest, no one hears it sort of thing, you're okay. So failure, at some level, is at the end of the day, a game of odds, right? So, you know, what's the probability of something happening? You know, there are some events that are relatively high probability. Disk drive failure rates, what, somewhere around 4 to 5% annual failure rates, right? At large scale, lots are failing every single day. So, you know drives are going to fail. And so you just kind of go deal with that. But turns out, you know, even low probability events start to happen at high scale. So, you know, we've got over 40 billion objects now. So an event that has the probability of 1 in a billion, you know, that doesn't sound like it's going to happen very often. Well, that's going to happen to 40 of our objects and growing, right? Within the system, we send trillions of messages around, you know, across this distributed system, responding to customer requests and doing things, right? Well, events that happen 1 in a trillion, again, really teeny small probability, right? They're happening, right? So, so I guess the net is, well, guess what? Failure happens. So, yeah, deal with it. You know, there's all sorts of failures. It's actually, I don't know, kind of one of the fun parts of the job. It provides some, you know, at the time is maybe not so fun, but looking back, it's like, wow, did that really happen? Wow, what were the odds of that? And wow, lightning struck there, okay. you know, this list, actually, every single one of these, except for actually the first one, which we've been very close to, we actually came very close to a tornado taking out one of our data centers, but it didn't quite. It just hit the parking lot. but every single one of these, actually, other than that, has happened, right? And you're just like, wow. Some of them have happened more than once, right? Yeah, the list is long. There's more things kind of going, but it's, you know, I guess it provides things to talk about over drinks when we all get together. But bad things do happen, so you just sort of have to plan on them. So, kind of think about failures a couple ways. So, when you have a failure, it can be small in scope or it can be large in scope. And so, if you take, say, a resource like, let's start with disk drives, right? You can have, well, it happening to none of your drives, right? or you could have it having all of your drives, right? And kind of at somewhere everywhere in between, right? And it's true for basically all the system resources. So, you know, it's true for network connectivity, it's, you know, it's true for disk drives and servers and whatnot. So that's sort of one access. Oops, wrong way. The second access is the duration, right? So failure can either be temporary. So you can have a process fail or a server die, reboot and come up. And in the process of rebooting, right, it's failed, it's away right now, it's not available. That's sort of a temporary failure. The other end of that access, right, are permanent failures, right? So your server could catch on fire, and once it's done burning, well, it's no longer available, and it's not ever coming back, right? And then there's stuff in between. So we've actually had we had a problem where the whole series of racks we had faulty power cords, so all the power cords were failing. Failures are fun. They're sort of interesting. You're like, wow, did that really happen? For a while we were walking around with little heat meters because we could only get to so many so fast to get all of them turned around. And so, we have folks walking around kind of looking for ones that were heating up, and we'd go target those first. And that's sort of a temporary failure, right? Because for that period of time, either if they failed or they're about to fail and you've unplugged it, right, you can't use it. But there's some odds that you're going to get that machine back. So those are kind of the axes. So down kind of at the origin, right, so where nothing's failed or where it's a temporary failure, those are basically harmless, right? And we like harmless failures. At the other end of the spectrum, right, is catastrophic failures, right? There's no coming back from these. And not only is there no coming back, but they happen to a broad enough scope that, wow, your business might not be coming back from this. So that's kind of the range. And the goal in thinking about how we engineer this stuff is, how do you take this graph and make basically the whole area be harmless and the catastrophic piece kind of go away, right? Now, again, it's a game of odds, so, you know, there are some combination of events always, right, that, you know, something wildly could happen, the asteroid hits the planet, well, there's nothing I can do about that, right, we're all gone. But there's this range of stuff in between, and there's the spectrum, and what we're trying to push out that where that harmless is, so that more and more of the things don't end up causing either a catastrophic or even an impactful event, right? And again, there's a variety of techniques to do it. You know, part of it is you can look at, you know, how do you engineer so that the scope of any failure is smaller, so you push the failures towards the origin, or how do you do things so that the duration is smaller, so that even if it's a large scope, it's like, you know, network flapping and you lose connectivity to a whole data center or something, how do you have that happen very quickly and then recover so that the impact is small? So we take these kind of our design goals, our the uncertainty that we face, and the failure that we know that's going to happen, and, you know, think about, well, how can we approach it? And I love this quote from John Wooden, in part because I'm a UCLA Bruin and I love Wooden, but I also like the sentiment here. And there's a lot of things that we just can't do anything about, right? Failure happens. I can't do anything about the fact that it will happen. I have uncertainty based on my business model and the goals that we're trying to achieve. There's a few things that I can do, but I can't always predict what customers are going to do. But what I can do is, you know, I can think about how do I engineer the system, and how do I, you know, find innovative and creative solutions that focus not on those things that I can't control, but focus on the things that I can control. So the first technique, this is probably the one that gets used most often, is redundancy, right? So redundancy can be used, for a variety of things, right? To cover a variety of resources in the system. So, you know, you have redundant disks, redundant servers, redundant network, redundant power, redundant cooling, redundant data centers, you know, all this sort of stuff. It's a very broadly applicable technique. It can increase durability, it can increase availability. But the flip side is it's also increasing your cost, and it's also adding to complexity, right? So it's a great tool, but it's one that you have to really be thoughtful about how you're using it. And so we have these jokes about seatbelts and airbags and belts and suspenders. So when we sit around designing, what we'll do is, you know, it's kind of like, you know, in a car where, you know, I've got redundancy in terms of I got both a seatbelt and an airbag. And I actually kind of feel pretty good about that redundancy, because if I were to get in a really bad crash, right, it could be catastrophic, right? That's one of those kind of catastrophic type failures. And it's worth spending on the redundancy to avoid the catastrophe, right? My life's kind of important. I'm willing to pay for both of those things. Contrast that with what we call belts and suspenders, right? So I got a belt on here today, right? It'd be a bummer if I lost my pants on stage, but, you know, I'd probably recover. you know, it wouldn't be a big enough bummer that I'm gonna go put on some suspenders too, right? I'm not gonna do that for a couple of reasons. One is, you know, negative style points, right? Two, it's gonna cost me a little money to go buy that extra set of suspenders. And three, it's just gonna make, you know, a whole bunch of things a little more complex, because now I gotta undo the belt and the suspenders and all this stuff, right? So what you wanna do is, you want to focus your efforts and redundancy on the seatbelt and airbag kind of things and not on the belts and suspenders type of things, right? And this is kind of, this is hard to do sometimes, right? Because it's hard to kind of tell sometimes which is which. But that's what you got to do. And one of the things that's interesting is that, you know, a lot of times once you put in kind of the seatbelt and airbag, and for us, you know, seatbelt and airbag is, you know, one of the things that we do is, you know, we basically redundantly store data in multiple data centers. So we've built out multiple data centers. We've got lots of them. Because we know that a catastrophic event can happen to an entire data center, right? That tornado could hit the building, not the parking lot, right? And it would have wiped out everything in there. And, you know, I probably wouldn't have wanted to put, like, software engineers on a plane to go dig through the parking lot and see if they can find disks that might still have data on them or something, right? Pretty much if that happens, it's gone. And events can happen. Probably low probability, but again, at scale, low probability events happen. Probability of an entire data center getting blown up or destroyed is relatively low, but if it were to happen, that could be very, very catastrophic if my data is only in that data center, right? So one of the things that we do is we say, okay, well, we're going to have multiple data centers. Well, that adds a bunch of cost and a bunch of complexity. But once we've done that, right, we've now got a substrate such that a lot of the other sorts of redundancies actually become belts and suspender types of things, right? Because if you've already got two data centers with redundant network connectivity and things like that, there's a lot of other things that you don't have to do. So again, we want to think about, you know, where to apply redundancy, where not to, where is it going to really help you from those core catastrophic things which you cannot recover from if you don't have it, and which are things that are kind of nice to have, but they're just really going to add cost and complexity. So I guess the loss of an entire data center is one. Another example is redundant transit, right? So if you've only got a single transit provider coming in and out, you're sort of bummed if they have an issue because you can't get anyone in and out. So, you know, having multiple, and things happen, right? You know, I think there was an issue a week or so ago with one of the major transit providers where they lost connectivity to a major portion of the United States, right? So what you want when those things happen is you want to say, well, I'm going to send my traffic someplace else, right? So there's a few of these kind of key areas where you really do want to look at spending on this thing, on redundancy. So the next technique that we use is retry. So, you know, back on that failure graph, right, there's the, you know, duration of failure events. And turns out a lot of failure is actually fairly short-lived, right? So it may be, you know, a host went down for some reason, it's rebooting, it'll come back up. You know, you see very short duration events with networking often, right, where routes will change and it'll take a small period of time to reconverge, and in that period of time, you can get failures. So by retrying, you can often resolve failures pretty quickly. By doing that, you improve your availability. So yeah, that's an example of sort of real time. You can also decide to, you know, if you're going through a process or you've got something that can wait, you can kind of put it in a queue and come back to it later and retry it. With S3, we do a fair bit of this, in part because, again, you know, the internet latency can be so high that often it's better for us to try a retry an operation internally once or twice before returning to the customer than trying to have the customer do it and have them retry on their end, and they're going to add the internet latency to the whole bit. So we use retry a lot. One of the things with retry is you can be smart about how you're retrying. So different parts of the system, you know, will be more or less susceptible to different types of failures with different sort of duration characteristics, right? So for some of the ones, the non-networking ones that don't resolve quite as quickly, you can leverage that redundancy that you've built, right? So if you've got, if you try accessing one of the disks that stores all or part of the object and you can't get it, well, try a different one, right? So you can leverage some of that redundancy you've built. And the last point, though, is an important one, and that's with retry, you have to be cognizant of idempotency, right? So what idempotency says is that you can redo the event and not have it change the ultimate outcome. So I like to think about this like, shampooing, right? In the morning, I get thinking about stuff, and sometimes I forget, have I shampooed or not? I can't remember, right? Well, just do it again, right? It doesn't really matter. There are lots of operations that, pretty easy to do that, Okay, so I washed my hair twice, who cares, right? Little extra money spent on shampoo, but no major loss, right? Lots of pieces in a distributed system are like that. Some are not without doing some special engineering. So, for example, it's a service that we charge for, so we have billing and metering operations, right? So when you make a request, we send a little message to the billing system, says, charge this person this amount, right? Well, if the billing system doesn't come back and say, yeah, okay, I charge this person this amount, what do you do, right? Did the billing system get the, can I, if I retry, are they gonna get double charged? If I send it, what's gonna happen, right? So in situations like this, in order to be able to retry, you've got to make sure that the component that you're interacting with is idempotent so that if the message that you'd sent, so if I'd sent the billing request to, or the meeting request to the billing system, and I didn't get a response because it successfully completed there, but there was something wrong in the message getting back to me, the okay, the act getting back, when I send it the next time around, it's going to reapply it unless the system's idempotent, in which case it'll get it again and it'll say, oh, I already got that, okay, no problem, I can ignore it, I've already seen that one, I'll just send you the act to know that I've got it, but I'm not going to go apply the change twice. So an important technique. So when talking about retry, sort of in the next sentence, you always have to talk about surge protection. So this is one of the classic things that's been kind of funny is you often see this with sort of new systems where, they haven't built retry, so they have their first sort of set of failures where the failure could have been avoided or the customer impact could have been avoided if they retried. So they go and build in retry, right? And then the next outage they have is because they don't have surge protection. So what happens is you get into the sort of states where components are starting to slow down or fail, and so you're retrying. Well, they're under load and they're failing because they're under load. You're not getting a response, so now you're doubling the load because you're retrying, and they're going, ow, stop, right? And so what you want to do is, while you want to retry, you want to be cognizant of how often, how frequent you're retrying so that you don't further push over a downstream component that might be struggling. So there's a couple of techniques for this, one of which is exponential back off. So you set a timeout for the first, for the first time you try, and you set it at X, right? And then the second, it doesn't succeed, so you retry it again, but this time you set the timeout at X squared, right? And you exponentially back off so that you're retrying, but you're not pounding the downstream system. So we use this in a number of places, and in fact, it's also something we'll tell customers to try as well, too, if they're having issues. The next technique is cache TTL extension. So in lots of places you use caches right in front of, to protect other parts of the system from load. And what can happen is if cache has TTLs on the objects, right, the TTLs start to expire, so they start to call the downstream system. Well, if the downstream system's down, and now as all of your TTLs start to expire, what happens is now you put extra load on that downstream system, which was used to having this cache in front of it, but now basically all of the caching's been wiped out. So now it's in an even worse state than it was, right? It's trying to come back up, but it's now got more load than it normally handles even when it's up because the cache is all gone. So one of the techniques that you can use is when you see this is you start to extend the cache TTL, right? So you go, okay, well, I'm starting to see problems here, and I'm starting to invalidate large portions of my cache because they're timing out, and I am not getting the refreshed data from the store below. So one of the things that you can do is basically say, okay, well, I'm going to basically I'll let it sit one more time. I'll try again a little bit later. And, you know, you have to, there's a set of trade-offs here, right? And you have to often kind of know a little bit about the system that you're in to figure out if this is a good technique or not. One of the places we use it is when you make a request to S3, one of the things that we go and check is the account in good standing, basically, right? Is the account still valid? Has it been, you know, is the bills paid and that kind of thing, right? When that service goes down, and we cache that information in front of it because we don't need to look at it on every single call, we look at it at some frequency. When that downstream service goes down and we can't figure out if the account is in good standing, the cache, you know, starts to invalidate, and we then start to fail requests if we don't have that data. So instead what we said is, well, we'll just make a business decision, say, you know what, it's kind of our fault that this downstream thing is failing, so what we're going to do is we're going to give our customers the benefit of the doubt, we're going to assume the account's in good standing, we're going to go ahead and serve the request, right? So they're happy, we pay a little bit of money for it, but the service still stays up. So that's an example. The final example, which is actually the first bullet, is rate limiting. And this deals with some of the customer uncertainty, as well as internal uncertainty. So you can see spikes, right? So, you know, the site gets tech crunched or something like this. And you can see sort of anomalous spikes and things. And most of the time, that's no big deal, right? But there is somewhere, even though it's virtually infinite, there is a ceiling of capacity at some point, right? So what you want to do is you want to make sure that you've got the ability to sort of start to rate limit so that if you're exceeding the capacity that you have, you don't let one or a small handful of customers take down the whole service, right? And that's true both for our external customers coming in or even us as a customer to some of, you know, the internal dependencies that we have, right? So if we're starting to do too much or send too many requests, we'll slow down the rate at which we're sending them. Or if a customer's sending us too much and they're knocking over some resource in the system, we'll limit the rate and provide surge protection that way. So the next technique is eventual consistency, and this is one that comes up a fair bit for us because I think it's not something that a lot of the systems have historically done. In terms of eventual consistency, there's a broad spectrum of the choices, so there's a lot of different ways that you can think about it. It's basically there's a trade-off between consistency, availability, and partition tolerance. And you know, you can tweak it. If you want more consistency, you end up with less availability, less partition tolerance, or you want more availability, you get, you know, less consistency. So we use it to enable us to get higher availability. So we will at times give up some level of consistency in order to gain availability. And that's a choice that we've made in the design of the system. Where it usually comes into play is when there are node failures. So when some portion of the system is unavailable, we want to be able to still go ahead. So if one of our data center fails or something like this, we want to be able to go ahead and process requests even though that resource is not available. And then allow the system to later catch up and converge to a consistent state. So with S3, we've made this trade-off a couple of ways. The first way, we trade off availability for some durability. So when you send a write to S3, we redundantly write it to across multiple data centers, right? And we won't return success for that request until all of the, you know, until we've successfully stored the object in a fully redundant way. But what that means is if we're unable to do that, we're going to fail, and that's a tick against availability. On the flip side, what we'll do is while we store all of the object data redundantly, we have multiple sort of pointers in multiple data centers that point to where that object is stored. So we have more pointers in more data centers than we have places where the object is stored, even though we store in multiple data centers. So on write, we will write to all the data centers that you're storing in, but we'll optimistically, so we basically fire and forget the pointer write in all of the other remaining data centers. And what that allows us to do is stay available in terms of if we're able to write the object, we can return success and be available for the write, even if we can't actually propagate the pointer to all of the other data centers. And so it improves availability for write, but then on read, if your request gets routed to one of those other data centers, you'll encounter the eventual consistency if the write didn't fail, if the propagation didn't occur. So if I send the write to data center A, propagate it to data center B, and later your request comes to data center B, it may say, I don't have this yet. And then we've got processes, we actually call them anti-entropy, to go through and sync up all of the stuff in the background if we missed some of that. So that's where eventual consistency comes into play. And it's basically, it's just these trade-offs, and different systems make them different ways. So the next technique is routine failure, right? Stuff fails all the time. Just treat failure as normal. It's, you know, no big deal. It's part of the day. We actually, one of the things is we want to make sure that we don't have code paths that are basically almost never accessed, because stuff that's almost never accessed, you can pretty much guarantee is buggy and doesn't work. And the last point you want buggy, doesn't work code is in a mode where you've already got stuff going wrong and you're trying to get it going right, right? So we actually routinely use our failure paths. So when we want to end of life hardware, we just unplug it and go, right? So we're just kind of brutal about it. And the system just has to recover from that. If we've got invasive maintenance that we need to do, we'll just turn off a data center, right? And we'll go do that invasive maintenance in the data center. And then when we're done with that, you know, the system will recover and handle it, and we'll done it on, we'll bring that data center back online. So by routinely doing this, we're kind of continually exercising these failure paths. So if the reason the data center was unavailable was because, you know, got hit by the tornado rather than we just took it offline, it would work just the same way. And we would have done it recently, and you know, the code paths would be well vetted and whatnot. Another technique we use is diversity. And there's lots of different diversity. And it's, again, sort of like redundancy. It's a bit of a double-edged sword. So we, you know, like with biological ecosystems, right? If everything's a monoculture, it's a lot easier to wipe out that monoculture than it is a more diverse one, right? And so we want to make sure that we have enough diversity so that things can't wipe us out. There's interesting stuff in here, right? So, you know, we try to keep a fair bit of diversity in our hardware, even though everything is commodity hardware, and we're actually very consistent about that. The diversity within that commodity hardware is fairly large, and this is a good thing, right? We've had situations. We got in 2006, we ordered a batch of hardware, and basically all of the drives failed in a very short period of time, right? And from this, you know, run of drives and this single vendor. You know, if all of our hardware had been at that, we would have been in a world of hurt, right? But instead, we had enough diversity, and we were, you know, we had different batches from different vendors, so that the scope of the failure was limited. You know, likewise, we had a problem where with the firmware for one of our storage servers, and we run with pretty dense boxes, and it was just. One of the drives would fail and it would nuke the whole server, right? So it was kind of a bummer. And so what you want is, the thing is, correlated failures actually do happen. And they happen in monocultures. And so you want to have enough diversity so that when they do happen, and they will happen, the scope of the impact is limited. And the same thing, goes for software too, right? So, you can have, we have multiple versions of software running at any given time, and this is helpful from a couple perspectives. One's, if you can support diversity in your software versions, it means you can do phased deployments, right? So we can roll out a software change, to a single server or to, a single subset of servers in a data center, or a single data center, or a single geographic region, or whatever, and kind of scale it up to really vet the thing. But it means that, while we're doing this, right, we've got all sorts of different versions running, all interacting and talking with each other. So, you've got to do a good job thinking about how you're going to version protocols and whatnot so that these all work together. So there's definitely cost and complexity associated with it, but it's one of these things where it's probably more in the seatbelt and airbag category that, you're really susceptible to broad scope of failure if you don't have some diversity. Finally, the last one is workloads, and sort of a bit of a different bent, and this one's, again, causes some complexity in that, having customers that are using us for high-performance computing along with customers that are using us for, serving thumbnails, right, is fairly different. But there's some value in being able to support both of them because you can interleave the workloads because they use different resources differently, and so this is one of the ways where you can have scale be a benefit. because you have places, some workloads which underutilize resources and some which use more of a different one, and by weaving them together, you can actually make a system that's both stronger and more cost-effective. So the next one is integrity checking. And this one, it's funny because keep finding sort of more and more places where you go, oh gosh, wow. But basically, any time that you've got bits anywhere, whether they're in, coming in, going out, at rest, whatever, all of those cases, they can get flipped, they can get corrupted. And so you have to be super diligent about paying attention to that and then checking for it. We found that, even things like, using TCP, right, which provides some amount of protection, isn't sufficient, right? We had NICs that basically where the TCP checksumming was offloaded to the NIC, it was getting the bits in, it was computing the checksum, and then corrupting the data. Bummer. And for those like system messages, we encountered a case where we were previously relying on TCP checksumming for some of this, and the system state messages, some of them got corrupted, and they got corrupted in such a way that prevented the system state from converging, so the system kept kind of going like this, trying to converge, and it couldn't, and it actually brought us down for a period of time. So we've since made sure that everywhere, right, we use application-level checksumming, because it's really only at the application level can you fully vet, is this thing conforming to what I want? Now, you want it every single level, right, because things can go wrong along the way, and having multiple checks helps a lot. You want it everywhere. And the other thing is then at rest too, right? So data stored on a disk, you put it there, you wrote these bits, you come back sometime later and that's not what you wrote. So again, you gotta check. We compute checksums as we're receiving an object. We actually have customers tell them to compute them before they send it to us. When we receive it, we compute it, and if we compute the same thing that they sent, then we tell them, good, we got it. Otherwise, we'll say, no, something happened, you need to resend it. And then we store the checksum so that when we pull something off disk, then we say, okay, well, is it the same thing I stored? So when we return it to a customer, we check it. And we actually also go through and we will periodically scan every single piece of data in the system, actually on a fairly regular basis, to recompute the checksums, because if you're not doing that on a fairly regular basis and you have basically cold objects, you could end up with all of your redundancy corrupted and not know it. So you want to be catching it relatively quickly so that you can then, you've got a good redundant copy of the data that you can restore from. So integrity checking is super important for both durability and availability of the system. So telemetry is another critical piece for us. Telemetry, this is the remote monitoring and measuring of what's going on in the system. And particularly at scale, this is really interesting and important for a couple of reasons. One is when you've got tons and tons of hosts and multiple data centers, you kind of don't know what's going on with them unless you got some data coming back, right? And you have to have sort of relatively sophisticated systems here. Or you easily get overwhelmed with the data, right? There's, there's also a tendency, you want, it's tough to find the right amount to log. On the one hand, you want to log everything, so if something happens, you can go figure out what happened and why. On the other hand, if you log everything, then you just, you've got literally, hundreds or thousands of petabytes, right, or terabytes of data that you've got to sort through and process in some way. So we use telemetry all over the place. We use internal measures and external measures. It's interesting when they're not the same, because then you can figure out, well, gosh, there's something going on here. You want to look at it on a host basis, you want to look at it on an aggregate basis, and then you want real-time numbers, and then you also want to go back and save the historical data so you can look at trends and see what's happening over time. And finally, the last piece is autopilot. Humans fail, too. And human response time is actually super slow. So relying on humans for things just doesn't work. So you really want the system to sort of be on autopilot and just run. We have a saying when occasionally something will happen and you look at you do the root cause analysis and you look at it and it's like, oh, well, this person kind of goofed up, right? But we actually never look at it that way. We never blame the person, because if there was a way for a human to goof up and cause a problem, there was a problem with the process or the tools. And so the problem is with the process or the tools, and you've got to go fix those so a human can't screw it up, because if they can, they will. All right, so let me just wrap up. So like I said, we had a series of design goals when we set out for S3. Ultimately what we wanted to do was build a storage system that would free developers from having to worry about storage so that they go focus on the application and on innovating in their space. So we had a pretty set of lofty goals, you know, be durable, available, scalable, secure, fast, simple, oh, and be really cheap too. So I think we've done pretty well achieving that. As with most goals, there's may be still some room for improvement, but I think we're doing a pretty good job of actually achieving all of these right now. In achieving them, you know, we use a set of techniques and tools. I've shared some of them today. There's a lot more that we use, but I think these are some of the more common ones that both we use as part of this system and are fairly commonly used across the rest of the company that I thought you all might find interesting. And then sort of final thoughts in my obligatory cloud slide, there it is, picture, it's in there. Is that, you know, one of the things with storage and thinking about building storage and you know, building a service like this is, it's a great responsibility, and it's also, there's a lasting relationship that you have with customers. When we talk about things sometimes, it's like, well, you know, what would happen if, you know, all of your child's baby pictures, right, were stored in the service and you lost them and never have them again, right? You know, what if, you know, all of your bank's financial records were in there, whatnot, right? So there's a broad range of stuff in the service. You know, all of it's important to someone. Every single object is precious. You can't lose it because you don't know what would happen if you lost it or corrupt it. It could be that, you know, that one and only picture or that key piece of data. Building a system like this, is a big responsibility, and it's something that then, you know, working with customers and partners, it's a relationship that requires trust, much more than a lot of other things. Your customer is putting a lot of trust on you to make sure that you're doing all the right things, right? Particularly with a service, it's, you know, even though we can talk about the things that we do, it's somewhat opaque, right? At the end of the day, you know, customer has to trust that you're going to do and take care of their data just as they would, or actually even at a higher level. In terms of, you know, doing this and achieving these things, right? You know, we believe that, you know, reliability at low cost is a hard problem, and we believe it can only be achieved really through a combination of both of engineering experience and scale. So with that. A few links for more information. The first is just the general pointer to the S3 landing page. We also have a blog that our evangelists write for web services. Werner Vogel is the CTO for the company and a distributed systems guy from Cornell back in the day. And he has a pretty good blog covering a bunch of these concepts. He's pretty good treatise on eventual consistency as well, if you're interested. Or if you've got questions or comments, feel free to email me directly. All right, thank you all. Appreciate it. Any questions? Yeah.
Hi, Samir Ajmani, Google. I worked on Bigtable for 2 years, so a lot of what you talked about is
you recognize.
Very familiar. I had a question about software diversity. I get the hardware diversity, uh-huh. You know, our data centers are upgraded all the time with,
yep.
I'm sure, different vendors, whoever's selling best, who knows. But software diversity, you know, we're the engineers, we're building our software, and yes, different versions are running in different places, but how do you really achieve a good diversity you're convinced has independence of failures? And it occurs to me that with cloud computing, we have the interesting opportunity that Amazon, Microsoft, Google could each implement the same interface, and you could have diversity at the application level across
sure.
those, and is that the right approach?
It's tough because, you know, I'm not sure there's any such thing as a right approach, right? You know, all of the stuff, there's, you know, with engineering, right, there's always a spectrum and it's always a set of trade-offs, right? So to answer the first part of your question, right, where's, you know, how much diversity is enough diversity? Well, it depends, right? And, you know, it is a set of trade-offs, and I think you'll make them differently across services, depending on what the services are doing. You'll even make them differently within a service, right? So there may be places where it's more critical path, you're more susceptible, or you know, there could be a variety of things that sort of influence your decision on a case-by-case basis. So I don't think there's any generality there. I think the generality just is that, you know, you're more susceptible if you have a complete monoculture. How far you go, right, and where you do it is arranged and dependent on a number of factors. In terms of across services, again, I think the same applies.
Hi, I'm Dave Rosenthal from the Stanford Library. I noticed that you have a numeric goal for availability, but not for the goal that you, or you didn't give one for the goal that you seem to regard as a lot more important, which is reliability. Do you have a numeric goal for it? Are you actually measuring how well you're stacking up against that goal?
When you say reliability?
In terms of losing and corrupting information.
Yes, we do. The thing with that, though, is it's a little funny, right? So if I were to tell you, there's a 99.9% probability I'll still have your object around. What do you do with that, right? obviously our goal has got to be we won't ever lose one, right?
But that's not realistic. You're going to lose stuff. I mean, we're talking about it's not like four nines for availability. The reliability goals need to be in the nine nines,
yeah, exactly.
And things like that. And so you are you
we
it's
do have
difficult
goals.
Even
yeah.
to measure that you're getting to those goals. And I'm interested in
our goal is 100%. It's an internal goal, right? Now again, we don't publish external measures on how well we're doing versus our goal on the availability. Although we do have a publicly facing availability SLA, which is at three nines, and we have financial penalties if we're short of that. So we do have goals on all these things. We do measure them all. They're just not things that we disclose.
Yeah, but your end user license agreement doesn't. There are no financial penalties if you lose stuff, right? The end user license agreement says it's my problem,
sure.
not
it's
your
true.
Problem.
And you know, when we started, we didn't have financial penalties on the availability side either, and we added that as a response to customer feedback, where customers were asking us, and they say, you know, well, we really wanted a SLA with financial penalties around availability. Honestly, we've not had that around the durability side. If we get the customer feedback on that, I'm sure we'll look at adding it. To date, we haven't. Again, that doesn't mean that we don't have it, because we actually do. Even if our customers aren't telling us it's the most important thing, we feel it is. So.
Yeah. Thank you.
I'm Stephen Spackman from Quantum. I'd like to ask you a political question.
Uh-oh.
In large-scale storage systems, there's an inherent tension between wanting to protect yourself against the day when the tanks roll in and you have an entire nation's worth of servers shut down, and the fact that many countries actually have laws against you offshoring people's data.
Mm-hmm.
How do you deal with this? How protected are we against, say, the United States going rogue and taking you out?
I don't know if I can answer that, but I will say though that we do have S3 today. We've got we've got two offerings, if you will. We've got a U.S. offering, which is actually and an EU offering. Both of those, anyone anywhere in the world can use either of the offerings. So it's not specific to where you are. It's specific to where you want your data to be. So we do have a European offering, and we have some set of customers. That some are in Europe, some are actually in elsewhere, that want to have the data stay in either in the EU or specifically don't want it in the US. So we do provide that option for customers.
But it's always good to have off-continent backups.
Yeah.
All right, hello, I'm Michael McStrow, a student at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, and I have a question about telemetry. I'm working on a project where I'm trying to monitor the state of a distributed file system. And so could you explain to me when you were trying to monitor the S3, could you explain to me how were you able to decide which attributes and everything you want to monitor and how you want to monitor those attributes?
Okay. So I'll say a couple things. One of the advantages, actually, of building the service at Amazon is actually Amazon's done a phenomenal job of building an internal platform for telemetry. So there's a bunch of stuff that we, as we're building the service, didn't actually have to go build all that infrastructure because it's there. So we were left with still hard problems around this, but not with the problem of building kind of the platform for the monitoring. I will say that this is one of the areas where we spend a lot of time. It's something that we're constantly tuning and constantly changing. There's a fine line between too much and not enough, and trying to figure out what the right points to measure are is hard and this kind of thing. So we have a lot of stats that we look at. We look at stuff on a per host basis. So we'll look at things like, how many IOPS are we getting out of this specific machine, right? What's the throughput that we can get out of it? How much CPU is being used in this one? So we look at some of that on some specific machines, right? We look at it in aggregate and slice and dice it in kind of different ways. We look at server sort of stuff. We also look at things like, from the customer perspective, right? How long is a put request taking, right? To go all the way, through and back, how often do those succeed and fail? And then we look at things from outside of our network, right? From external monitoring nodes to figure out, was there some problem in the DNS resolution path, right? So there's a variety of things. I think we usually start with, the core that we start with is, okay, well, what are our customers doing? And do we have monitoring that maps what the 80% of what our customers are doing, right? That's number one, right? Because you want to know. There's nothing worse than having your customers tell you about a problem that you didn't know about yourself, right?
Yeah.
Bad. So, we usually start there. And then you start to look at, okay, well, what are the key dials, right? Do I know where, are there bottlenecks that I know about in my system, right? Usually you want to go have a bunch of monitoring metrics around your bottlenecks and see how you're doing there. And one of the interesting things that you find, honestly, is that actually bottlenecks shift over time. So sometimes, you'll have one and, something will happen. Either you've actually improved, the throughput of this component or something, right? And now you've got this bottleneck over here, and you have to have enough monitoring around so that you can observe that that's happening. So, I don't know. And not a super crisp answer, but it's not a super crisp problem.
Yeah, exactly.
Good luck.
Hey, Kiran from Harvard University. So you spoke about security in your talk. So, if my competitor's data is on S3, I can drive up his cost by just downloading the data a lot of times or performing a number of operations on that data. So do you guys see that kind of attacks, or are you guys doing something about that?
I'm sorry, I didn't fully get the question. Can you?
So the question is, if I put my data on S3, and so I'm being charged for the number of times the data gets downloaded or the number of operations that are performed, right? So my competitor can drive up my cost by going in and downloading the data a lot of times, or sort of doing a DDoS kind of attack.
Oh, I see. So you're saying you store data, but you make it publicly available, but you sort of want to have some limits around the public availability, but...
I see.
Yeah, so there are a number of ways. It's a squishy thing, because it is just that, right? You've said, I want to make this data publicly available, but if the public is my competitor, what do I do, right? Mm-hmm. In practice, there's a couple of things, right? One is, we do provide tools so you can see, it's called a usage report, so you can see what's being used. You can see which IPs are calling you and things like this. So we give you visibility into the data so you can figure out if you have a problem or not, right? And then there's a variety of steps that you can take. And we also, things will happen where, malicious activity, right, can and does happen, right? We do a lot of monitoring for that ourselves, right? Mm-hmm. And, sometimes we'll see something that looks really odd and we'll actually contact customers and go, well, what's going on here, right? And, we've had customers go, well, gosh, thank you. It looks like, more often than not, usually it's a bug in their code someplace and they didn't realize that their process went, and so we'll work with customers that way. If there actually is something malicious, we actually will often work with them and the authorities to go and shut down, and then we work out the financials for that. We'll usually...
Thank you.
Hi, Dan Ellard from BBN Technologies. Part of this was absorbed in the previous question, but let me just ask it explicitly. Is there any chance you can make some of these logs, some of your telemetry information, in a sanitized format available to the research community?
So not something we've thought much about. It's an interesting idea. We do have, individual customers can make their logs and information available to whomever they want, because you can sign up for logging and we'll drop basically the web server logs into your bucket so you can see exactly what's going on. You know, I haven't really thought about doing it broadly in part because honestly it's not our data kind of, right? I mean, it's the request patterns and usage is really the property of our customers, not of us. So I don't know, it's an interesting thought, not something that we've really given much thought to, yeah.
Hello, Jay Danielson from Sun. I have a question on a couple of use cases that came to mind that might be treated differently, I think. And how would you handle, do you have customers that might use the service like seasonally, like maybe at Christmas time I want to use it, but not at other times of the year? How long do you persist the objects there? Would they be there still the next, if I didn't use the service for some period of time and then came back? And then hang on one sec, so I got, and then the other use case would be, intentional. The other one would be like unintentional, like, oh, my credit card expired or something like that. Would my objects be deleted immediately, or how long would they stick around?
Let's see, now I got to remember both parts. Okay, so the first part was, if I only use it, can I only use it seasonally, yeah. What happens, right? So basically with S3, there's kind of two kinds of use, right? There's the, you know, I've stored something with you and it's at rest and we will bill that for you every month that it's sitting there and you've got an account, right? Because who knows, maybe you're using us for archive, we don't know, right? And what you've done is just archive that data and your intention is to never really access it unless for some reason you need to. So you would have storage charges but no request charges during that period. And certainly we have customers that do that. Hard to tell whether it's just a seasonality thing or it's an archive use case or whatnot, I don't know. So we have customers that do that. The second is, well, what happens if I don't pay my bill, right? And you can read our terms of use. I think there's specific language around what happens there. The general thing is we go through great lengths to, you know, contract customers and work with them, and we don't want to just
get an email
data,
or,
right?
Or a series of emails on that or something.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.